I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. You can visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Once again, I have my father to thank for a very fine recommendation for a morning show guest. He and his wife, my stepmother, have thoroughly enjoyed exploring a fascinating book called This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto. And they both urged me to seek out the author of this book, Suketu Mehta, who is a associate professor of journalism at New York University. And indeed, this is a book very much worth exploring and discussing. Suketu Mehta has written a book that is, in some respects at least, deeply professional, and yet also an objective exploration of some of the most difficult issues that surround immigration, particularly immigration in this current climate in which such a large swath of the U.S. population has essentially risen up in ferocious resistance to the whole notion of immigrants, and in particular undocumented immigrants. And in this book, Suketu Mehta explores the many ways, first of all, in which our country and our lives have been enriched in profound ways by what immigrants have brought to our country and contributed to our collective life. But his book also explores some of the ways in which we have exploited the very countries from which many of these immigrants come, exploited them over the course of many, many decades. And that, once one understands that, really sets this whole situation of immigration in a very different light. I learned a great deal from reading this book, and I'm now very excited to be able to speak with its author. The book, again, is This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and its author, Professor Suketu Mehta. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, and thank your father and your stepmother for me for the recommendation.
So I think it would make a lot of sense if we could first know the perspective and experience from which you are writing this book. In other words, I think it's important for us to begin by knowing your own life story, something about where you were born and where you grew up, and then at what point the United States became your home, and what your experience has been here.
Sure. So I was born in Calcutta, and I grew up in Calcutta and Bombay, what is now Mumbai. And I moved with my parents and my two younger sisters to New York, particularly to the Jackson Heights neighborhood of the borough of Queens, which is by some measures the most diverse neighborhood in the country. I was 14 when we moved in 1977, and I have lived in New York most of the years since. I went back to Bombay to research and write my first book, which is called Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. And then I have been writing a book about New York City for the last decade or so, but But in 2016, after Trump got elected, I realized that there was something more urgent that I needed to do. And that was to write a book about immigration, not just to the United States, but around the world. Because never in my lifetime had I seen people more demonized for the simple, very human act of migration, which our species have been doing since the dawn of time. We have never been more vilified just because we needed to move for a better life for ourselves and our families, or just because the rich countries have made life so intolerable for people in the poor countries that they have no option but to move. So I started writing this book, and it came out in hardcover last year, and it's now coming out in paperback on August 4th.
Mm. You write close to the beginning of the book, "This book is being written in sorrow and rage as well as hope." Can you tell us more about the feelings that are behind those words?
Sure. So the book begins with a story that my grandfather once told me. My grandfather was born in India and then worked in Kenya when it was still a British colony, and then retired in England. And he was sitting in a park in London in the 1990s one day, and this elderly British gent comes up to my grandfather and says, "Why are you here? Why don't you go back to your country?" And my grandfather, who was a businessman, he said, "Well, we're here because we're the creditors. You came to my country and you stole all my gold and my diamonds and my minerals. So we have come here to collect. We are here because you were there." And the story he told me, you know, set me thinking about why are people on the move like never before? Today, a quarter of a billion people live in a country that is not there. So what is it that makes people move? What is it that makes people undergo desperate journeys, taking their little children in their arms and crossing the Rio Grande or crossing the Mediterranean in small boats? They're not all going to see the Eiffel Tower or the lights of Broadway. They're going because they have no choice. And what I point out in my book is that the rich countries have, through colonialism, war, inequality, and climate change, they have made life so intolerable for people in the poor countries that they have no option but to move. So let's take colonialism. You know, the question put to my grandfather, which is, why are you here? Why don't you go back? When the British arrived in India at the beginning of the 18th century, India's share of world GDP was 23%. So almost a quarter of the world's GDP came from India. By 1947, when the British left, India's share of world GDP was under 4%. During the entire colonial period, the European share of world GDP went from 20% to 60%. So the Europeans went into all these countries and they stole all they could. And it's not just what they did when they ruled over these countries. It's how they left. 40% of all the borders on the planet today have been made by just two countries, Britain and France. The endless wars between Pakistan and India and Bangladesh, much of this happened because of the British-made boundaries. When the British left, they divided the country into three places. It's the same story with African countries. If you look at a map of Africa, it abounds in straight lines which cross across tribal homelands. And many of these civil wars in Africa, which seem incomprehensible to some Western minds, are as a direct result of these tribes trying to regather themselves into nations. When the colonizers left, they left behind their corporations. So if you go to any of these African countries, and in my book, you know, I've traveled widely around the world and spoken to migrants about, you know, why they've left. So I met this small family from Guinea that was trying to cross from Morocco to Spain with their newborn baby. in a tiny dinghy, and I was really scared for the baby's life. But they had no choice because Guinea has been rendered bankrupt, and part of the reason it's been rendered bankrupt is because of the Western multinationals that have gone there and ripped off the country. So Guinea has, it's not a poor country. It's got up to half the world's bauxite. But there is one hedge fund, it started in America, it's called the Oxif Corporation, and it paid, has huge businesses in Africa. It's paid hundreds of millions of dollars for fines to the SEC and the Justice Department for corrupt practices in Africa. Its executives have gotten very rich. It's the same story in many other African countries. And it's not just what the multinationals do when they're in there. It's what happens to the revenues that are supposed to go back to the African countries, but instead go to international tax havens. 40% of the world's multinational profits are immediately moved to tax havens. Every year, $150 billion leaves Africa alone for tax havens. This is money that should be going to African school children and to build African roads. Let's take war. I mean, people say the United States is not a colonizer. We were a colony ourselves. But if you look at the American record in Central America, for example, in propping up dictator after dictator. At one point, 42% of all the land in Guatemala was owned by just one American company, the United Fruit Company. And the U.S. has, in country after country, installed leaders that are friendly to U.S. policies. It's not just Central America. Look at the Iraq War, this illegal and unnecessary and extremely bloody war caused by Americans, in which 600,000 Iraqi lives were lost. I submit that we should now let in 600,000 Iraqis into the country, one life for every life that was taken as a direct result of our actions.
I think there's a place in your book, I think, where you talk about how immigration, in one respect at least, can be seen as a kind of reparation for this kind of harm that has been done in some of these other countries. Would this be an example of that?
I am calling for immigration as reparations. And I think if we have to have quotas, I don't believe there should be national quotas, but if we are to have quotas, then each country should let in people from the countries that it has despoiled. So, for example, Britain should have lots of Indians and Nigerians. Americans should have Dominicans and Salvadorans. France should have Haitians and West Africans. But the biggest driver of migration caused by the West is yet to come, and that's climate change. The United States has 4% of the world's population, but we put one-third of the excess carbon in the atmosphere. European countries, another one-third. But, you know, we walked away from the Paris Accords. And the result of this is that the entire world is suffering from climate change. And by the middle of the century, up to 1 billion people will be displaced by climate change. Where are these people going to go? Well, if there's any natural justice, then the countries that caused the problems should let in people from the countries that they've despoiled. My book is written in, yes, in sorrow and in rage, because the entire debate about global migration is from the point of the view of the rich country. What's in it for us? Should we let in migrants or not? Should they be skilled or unskilled? How many? From what places? And what I'd like to ask is, I'd like to turn the tables and say, why are these people moving in the first place? And what are they owed by the countries that have had this direct role in shaping their present plight?
We're speaking with Sugeto Mehta about his book, This Land is Our Land, an Immigrant's Manifesto. I want to explore a little bit further this matter that you call in Chapter 6 of your book, The New Colonialism. And that is the idea that, although we don't think now of colonialism as being a force in the world as it once was, But there is this new colonialism, which you call corporate colonialism. You say when the colonial regimes withdrew their soldiers and viceroys, they replaced them with their businessmen. And, of course, you've already recounted some of what we are talking about. I want to have you expand on something you say a little later in this chapter about that goes beyond even the matter of how multinational corporations are often exploiting these poorer countries in all kinds of different ways. But then beyond that, you write, a multinational corporation is impervious to liability precisely because it operates in multiple nations. Cut off a limb in one and it grows another somewhere else. So we have a border-free world for multinationals. Tell us more about how this happens, or the way in which multinational corporations end up not being as accountable as we might assume they are or hope they would be.
So I first became aware of this issue, the shape-shifting nature of the multinational, when I went to the Indian city of Bhopal, which is, along with Chernobyl, the site of the world's greatest industrial disaster, which was caused by an American-owned pesticide plant owned by the American corporation Union Carbide, which is now part of Dow Chemical. And in 1984, this plant blew up because the corporation had cut off safety mechanisms to save money. And the plant blew up, and this gas cloud floated over the sleeping city of Bhopal, and tens of thousands of people lost their lives immediately after the disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people were maimed, and there are now birth defects in the third generation of survivors. So what did Union Carbide do? It got out of India. It paid a nominal amount of damages and just eliminated its Indian subsidiary and went on its merry way and conducted its business elsewhere, and then sold the company itself to Dow Chemical. So the site of the disaster, which I spent quite a lot of time in, they still haven't cleaned up the toxins, and there are still people suffering, and they could get away with it because it's a multinational corporation. And these survivors, when they tried to sue Union Carbide in American courts, they were told that wasn't the proper venue. They had to do this in Indian courts. But when they tried to do this in Indian courts, you know, the company, of course, had left. And what was left of Union Carbide paid a nominal fee. And in fact, the U.S. government prevailed on the Indian government to pass legislation guaranteeing American chemical corporations, American corporations, immunity from liability. Otherwise, they might not invest in the country. So this is an absolute outrage. Imagine if an Indian corporation had come to Wisconsin and put up a plant and was grossly negligent in how it ran its operations. It blew up and tens of thousands of American lives had been lost. What would have been the result? I mean, there might have been military action against India if the corporation didn't pay up. But what do we do if the U.S. invades India? Then India can take the U.S. to the United Nations, raise questions in the Security Council. But if Union Carbide wreaks horrible damage in an Indian city, where do we go after Union Carbide? There's no International Court of Justice for corporations. And so I realize the ways in which these multinationals can go across borders and do what they want. And it's not just things like environmental damage. It's what happens with the money that they make, with this international regime of tax havens and the international financial system. So, you know, there are people who say, where are all these Mexicans coming here? Well, between 1970 and 2010, Mexico lost $872 billion in what's called illegal financial outflows, most of it going from corporations doing business in the country to American banks. During that same period, 16 million Mexicans came to the United States. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just following the money, their money.
It's interesting. That phrase, follow the money, comes up quite a lot in your book, and that's one of the most important things for us to do. And, of course, following the money can be challenging sometimes when it comes to a complicated, interconnected world.
That's right. There are these accountants and lawyers who set up this dizzying array of corporations and shell corporations and limited liability organizations. And so the Panama Papers, for example, showed this worldwide network of tax havens, among which, the British Empire, and there is still a British Empire, and its far-flung tax havens like the Cayman Islands, and the City of London itself, which is the world's biggest tax haven. A lot of this money, which should be going to the countries that these corporations are based in, instead flows out of these countries and to these tax havens where it's untraceable. And it's not just, the corporate executives from these countries. It's the local elites that they co-opt and corrupt. If you go to any of these African countries and you go to the best hotels in the capital, the Sheraton or the Hilton or the Ritz-Carlton or whatever, you'll notice, groups of generally white men, executives, huddling with groups of the local generals and dictators and kleptocrats plotting how to divide up the country's resources among themselves. I mean, the numbers are really astonishing, and there are very good organizations who are following the money, like Global Witness. There are a number of NGOs that are doing this. And much more needs to be done so that we understand that these countries aren't just impoverished because their people are unwilling to work or because they're stupid or something. They are in a terrible situation because of colonialism, war, inequality, and climate change. Corporate colonialism, which has replaced imperialism, has a lot to answer for.
Would it be fair, however, to say that some of these multinational corporations have provided employment opportunities in some of these countries that that would otherwise not exist? What would you respond to what I suspect would be kind of the first line of defense were a spokesperson from one of these multinational corporations part of this conversation? What would be your response to that?
Look, I believe in free trade. I believe in open markets as well as, in some sense, open borders. I believe that human beings and capitals should flow across countries. I think it was a good thing for Europe to remove the borders to trade internally. I also think that it's good when America trades with Mexico and with Canada, but they should trade on a fair basis. And the problem with multinationals isn't that capitalism is evil and we should, everything should be owned by a state. I grew up in a socialist country in India, and I saw the ways in which governments can be as corrupt as corporations. But the problem is with the regulation of multinationals. The multinationals go into these small countries and they pick and choose which laws they're going to follow and which laws they're not going to. So, for example, when the Anglo-Dutch corporation Shell went into Nigeria, and it had all these oil operations in Nigeria in the Delta region. The Ogoni people, these were people who lived in the Delta region, but they found the resources exploited, and the Delta region turned into an environmental wasteland. And there was an incredibly brave activist named Kinsara Wivi, who was launched a movement against Shell, and he was imprisoned and executed by the Nigerian government. And Greenpeace has shown the ways in which Shell has been complicit, along with the Nigerian military, in ruthlessly suppressing the Ogoni people. In fact, I met a woman, a Nigerian woman from the Delta region, in the city of Tarifa in southernmost Spain, and she told me why she had to flee in a small boat across the Mediterranean with her newborn child, because the land where she lived had been utterly despoiled by Shell and the Nigerian government. So I believe that companies should be allowed to operate, but I also think that there should be regulation, and these countries, these multinationals, should be bound by the same laws in other countries as they are at home. So, for example, tobacco or soda consumption. U.S. corporations, as they've found tobacco and soda companies, as they found increasing regulation of their products in the U.S., have looked to other countries with weaker regulatory mechanisms to spread their poisons. So, and they've used American diplomats and trade sanctions to force some of these countries, these weaker countries, to pass legislation that is beneficial to these merchants of debt. Mexico, for example, tried to pass a tax on soda because it's got the highest level of obesity on earth. And, you know, Coca-Cola and other companies and the Mexican subsidiaries fought this tooth and nail, and Mexico was not able to pass a soda tax. So we see all these ways in which Western companies, these multinationals, go into these countries, and it's fine as long as they create employment and help these countries, you know, create expertise and use their resources sensibly. But that's not all they're doing.
Right. And could I just ask, is it important for us to not paint with too broad a brush here? That is, are there examples? Probably not nearly enough in your view, I'm sure. But can we point to certain situations in which multinational corporations have behaved with at least some level of responsibility and sensitivity to the people of the countries where they are located? Or by and large, do you think these multinational corporations, just by their very nature, are almost unavoidably guilty of the misdeeds that that you're talking about here?
So I think there are, you know, good and fine people in multinationals who go and work for, I don't know, Exxon or Unilever or Coca-Cola or Apple, you know, wanting to do good. But it's a corporation, after all, and the mantra that's used is that we have to increase shareholder value. We are responsible to our shareholders. If we don't show a consistent rate of growth every year, if we don't deliver more and more profits, then the shareholders will lose value. And ultimately, the end goal of the multinational isn't to do good in the world. It's to make money. It's the profit motive. And so whatever gets in the way of that profit motive, you know, it can only, that impulse to do good isn't going to come from the nature of the corporation. It has to come from the law. It's got to come from regulatory mechanisms, as it is in the United States. I mean, you know, even in the Trump era, there are still very strong environmental and regulatory mechanisms that police the behavior of multinationals, which are almost non-existent in many of the countries that they operate in. And they go after the weakest countries because that's where they can, you know, do what they do and make the most money without fear of regulation.
Right. We're speaking with Suketu Mehta, and we're talking about his book, This Land Is Our Land, and Immigrants' Manifesto. One thing we have not yet, I think, sufficiently talked about, and I wish we had more time to talk about this, but one of the sections of your book is called Why They Are Feared, in which you sort of take apart what you call the populists' false narrative that has fostered such fear and anger, which, of course, eventually spills into outright hatred when it comes to allowing immigrants into our country. And this is something playing out, of course, not only here in the United States, but in plenty of other countries as well. What do you think is going on at this moment in time that this so-called false narrative is taking hold as effectively as it is? I mean, why are we, in a sense, vulnerable to this, or why has such a persuasive narrative been formulated at this point in time?
So what I say in my book is that the fear of migrants is causing incalculably greater damage to the West than the migrants themselves ever could. In country after country, people are electing leaders based on the fear of migrants, of this imagined horde. And these leaders get into power on the strength of the xenophobia, and they turn their attention to minorities within their own countries. So if you look at Poland, if you look at Hungary, if you look at England, the United States, you have all these populist leaders in power who, once they get in power, they energetically set about dismantling the courts, the free press, and they go after minorities in their own countries. Take a look at England, for example, where people voted for Brexit, the biggest own goal in British history, based on a fear of migrants. A huge factor in the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was his arousing of these nativist passions against Mexicans, calling them robbers and rapists and drug dealers. And a lot of people voted for Trump on the basis of that fear. And now we have this man who is president of the country during one of its greatest crises, and has been shown to be manifestly one of the worst presidents in the country's history. And he came to power on this wave of migrant hatred. Hungary, where I've spent some time, Viktor Orban in Hungary, he is one of the most xenophobic politicians in the world. And what he's done is attack the free press, attack the Roma, dismantle the courts. And Hungary right now is a terrible state. It's so successfully stopped migrants that it's demanding that Hungarians work more, work longer hours, because they just don't have the labor that they need to operate their factories and their businesses. In country after country, whether it's Bolsonaro in Brazil or Putin in Russia or Modi in India, there are these populists who come to power on the basis of narrative. And a populist basically is a gifted storyteller. He's a man, and almost always they're men, who can tell a false story well. And the only way he can be fought is by telling a true story better. So that's what I try to do in my book. And that's why journalists are under attack all over the world, because we're the truth tellers. We can separate what's true from what's false. And that's why we're being attacked as fake news, whether it's in Modi's India or Trump's America.
Hmm.
Because they know that we're the ones who can challenge the narrative.
In the fourth part of your book, this is, I suppose, part of where we tap into the hope with which you write this book. The fourth part of your book is titled Why They Should Be Welcomed. And in this section of your book, you really celebrate what diversity is all about and what diversity brings to a given country, or for that matter, to a given neighborhood, to a given school. And I would like to just give you a couple minutes to just kind of expand on this very, very basic point. Describe what you see as the beauty of diversity as you see it played out, for instance, in the remarkable city of New York City, where you and your family currently live?
So I came to America as a teenager, and I was lucky enough to come to New York City, and even luckier to come up in Queens, where in the zip code 11372, where I grew up, there were something like 160 languages that were being spoken. And Jackson Heights now is the epicenter of the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. It's been hit really hard because of its density and the lack of services, particularly hospitals. A number of hospitals had been shut down, and Elmer's Hospital, which, you know, I knew as a child, have been just an absolute disaster area. But Jackson Heights has not fallen apart. And it's a place where, you know, when I walk around those streets, I'm filled with hope for the country and for the human race, because here are people from all over the planet. I mean, I grew up in a building filled with Indians and Pakistanis and Haitians and Dominicans and Jews and Muslims. The building was owned by a Turkish man, but he'd hired a Greek super. I mean, these were all people who were killing each other just before they got on the plane. And here we were living in one building. And, you know, it's not like we were all loving each other, but we agreed to get along because we were making a new life in a new country, and our kids played together in the courtyard. This is the American exceptionalism, and this is why I still love America, because it's a country made up of all the other countries. This is what we should be celebrating. This is what gives me hope. So my book begins in sorrow and rage, but ends in hope, because immigration is a win-win game for everyone. It's a win-win game for certainly the migrants who've got to move, who have to move because they appreciably increase the standard of living, and in the case of refugees, they actually get a chance at life itself. It's a winner for the countries that they move to, because the rich countries aren't making enough babies, and they need the energy and the expertise of immigrants. I mean, take the U.S. Alone. Immigrants are 14% of the American population, but we started a quarter of all new businesses and earned over a third of all the Nobel Prizes in science given to Americans. One in four U.S. tech companies have an immigrant founder. 71% of the people working in Silicon Valley are immigrants. So right now, you know, Trump and Stephen Miller, his immigration advisor, they want to essentially ban all migration, documented or undocumented, skilled or unskilled. This would be an enormous disaster to the United States, among other things, because Social Security would be bankrupt if not for immigration. I mean, the thing that is saving Social Security right now is immigrants. Starting this year, the Social Security Administration is spending more money than it collects. By 2035, its $3 trillion reserves will be completely gone, and you will only get 80% of the Social Security that you're entitled to, unless immigrants come in, unless the country lets in more immigrants, because immigrants are younger than the native-born, they work longer, and in the case of the undocumented, they pay into Social Security, but they don't receive benefits. So economically, the numbers are pretty much indisputable, and, you know, economists are generally unanimous, with a few exceptions, that immigration is economically good for the countries that people move to. But it's also good for the immigrants themselves, because if you want to make the world a better place, if you want to help the poorest people, then let people move and let them send back money. Remittances, the money that, you know, people spend in $5 and $10 and $50 money orders back to their countries, it's four times greater than all the foreign aid in the world. And this is money that poor people in the countries that they move, in the rich countries, they send back to their grandmother for her medical treatment, they send back to their siblings to get educated or to build a house. Last year, remittances were over $300 billion. So immigration benefits everyone, and it's been a fact of human life for, you know, all our history as a species. The whole system of passports and visas, it's only about 100 years old. We shouldn't accept it as a given. Like the birds and the animals, you know, human beings move. And generally, we make the places that we go to better. And for those people who are saying, well, you know, you should only come here when you're legal, you should respect our borders. Ask yourself this question. Has the West ever respected anyone's border? So my book begins in sorrow and rage, but ends in hope because I see it all around me. I see it not just in New York, but in places like Raleigh, North Carolina, where my brother-in-law, who is an Indian-American of Bengali descent, he was born in Fayetteville, he ran in 2016, in the year that Trump got reelected, he ran for North Carolina Senate, and it was his first political race ever. And he ran in a district that is 90% white. And I went around with him knocking on doors, and he was running against a white opponent. But he won in a landslide, and he's now the first Indian-American state senator in North Carolina history, and is the chief whip of the Democrats in the North Carolina Senate. So in this country, it's possible
for
a man like my brother-in-law, Jay, the son of immigrants, to come and run for office and get elected. The country still, I think, with the vast majority of Americans, think of ourselves as a nation of immigrants.
And one of the things that you say is that for all of the rhetoric that dominates the headlines in terms of this issue, you say Americans and their northern neighbors, I assume you mean Canada, are still the most welcoming people in the world for immigrants. That's kind of a remarkable statement to make.
So I think it is still true, and certainly there are large parts of America and Canada where immigrants are met with hostility and suspicion. But Canada has announced that it wants to increase its immigrants threefold. It's a big, empty country. We need warm bodies for cold countries. I like living in America. I'm an American citizen. I've also lived in Brazil. I never felt I could be Brazilian. I've lived in England. I really didn't think I could be English. I've lived in France. I didn't think I could be French. Here in New York, you can be American the moment you step off the plane at JFK. Because, you know, these countries, I think by and large, the majority of people know that somewhere in their family tree, unless you happen to be one of the First Nations or the Native Americans, that you basically come here, your families come here from somewhere else. I mean, we have an incredibly nativist anti-immigrant president who is himself the son of an immigrant. His mother came from Scotland when she was 16. So, and we know most Americans who have everyday lived experience of immigrants, particularly in the cities, they know that immigrants aren't here to rob and to steal. They're here to work and to make the country great again. So the hostility is really manufactured, and I think it's manufactured for political reasons, so that these people can ride to power on xenophobia. And I think in this election, in the 2020 election, Donald Trump's going to try to use the same trope, and he's going to try to use the coronavirus as a way to get reelected by saying, look, we're losing American jobs, so we should just shut our borders. We've got enough people unemployed here. And that really, if you examine it closely, it falls apart because immigrants are job creators. As I mentioned earlier, I've got a whole chapter on the ways in which immigrants come here and make jobs. Bill Gates went before Congress and said that for every tech worker that the country lets in, 5 American jobs are created. Over half of all the billion-dollar tech startups today have an immigrant founder. And today they employ these immigrant-run tech companies, employ over 500,000 Americans.
You also tell us that immigrants, you encourage us to allow immigrants to, in a sense, remain who they are and to make choices for themselves in terms of their own assimilation into our culture. You pose this question: will the new immigrants fully assimilate? Does it matter if they don't? Immigrants should have the freedom to not melt entirely into any sort of pot, to speak in their language as well as their host countries, worship their God, marry as they choose. That is the meaning of being American. I mean, it's so interesting to think about that definition of what it means to be American, because, of course, it flies in the face of what a certain swath of the public in this country would say it means to be American. You are asking us to broaden our sense of what the heart and soul of America is all about.
So, I don't think there's ever been a universally accepted definition of what being American means. In the 1700s, Benjamin Franklin railed against these people who were coming into the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And he complained that there were these people coming in, they don't speak our language, they worship strange gods, their customs are totally different from ours, why are we letting these people in? You know who he was talking about? Germans, the ancestors of the current president. So there's always been these waves of xenophobia or nativism. In the 19th century, the Know Nothing Party was incredibly influential and held lots of seats in legislatures across the country. And they were basically anti-Catholic and anti-Irish. And now we've got this wave of nativism against all immigrants, but particularly Latino immigrants. So I grew up in New York City where, you know, two out of three people are children or their immigrants. Two out of three people are immigrants or their children. And these are people who speak their own languages. You can get along in New York perfectly well speaking only Spanish or Bengali. And there are parts of Brooklyn where there are still old grandmothers who mostly speak Italian, who know very little English. And they get along just fine. They can find work. They can find a mate. They can deal with the government speaking the languages. This is not a bad thing as long as the kids go to school and get an education and learn English and learn about other people. I don't think that when immigrants come in, we should expect them to melt into a pot. Neither should we expect their children to melt into a pot. I came here and I learned about baseball. I learned how to play baseball and softball. But I also played cricket in Flushing Meadows Park. Because I learned how to play baseball doesn't mean that I've got to stop playing cricket. I can play both cricket and baseball. And I think it adds to the country. It adds to, you know, the wonderfulness of America. There are these people who come here from all over the world and bringing in their food and their languages. It enriches the country. It does not diminish it.
Absolutely. It brings to mind something from your epilogue when you write, "This is the American exceptionalism. It's a country made up of all the other countries. This is why I'm proud to call it my country. It may not be the reason I came, but it is the reason I stay." The book again is This Land Is Our Land, an Immigrant's Manifesto, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and the author, Suketu Mehta. Professor Mehta, it's been a real privilege and honor to speak with you about your fascinating and illuminating book. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a couple of different interviews, including an interview with the author of a book called How to Talk About Race. This is actually a book designed mostly for parents, grandparents, teachers, mentors, giving some ideas on how to talk about complicated issues related to race with children. Later this week, you'll hear my interview with Mark Freeman, who's written a wonderful oral history about Modern Family, the groundbreaking sitcom that has just gone off the air after 11 successful years. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost.